This is Bristol Bay and Beyond, KDLG's weekly news magazine. It's Friday, March 17th. I'm your host, Dave Benninger. Thanks for joining us, and happy St. Patrick's Day. Coming up this week, the state's budget inches forward in Juneau. Speaker Bryce Edgman offers an update.
The caucus I'm involved in believes that we have already cut the budget considerably over the years, and to cut it further is to eliminate core services. We think that our problem is more around the lines of creating a comprehensive fiscal plan.
Plus, this week, a once-a-month injection is proving quite successful in treating opiate addicts, but so far is finding few proponents around the state. One person who believes it needs more attention tells us why.
It allows your brain to stop craving opioids and alcohol within 3 hours of getting the injection. You could walk to your dealer and think, you know what, actually, I'm okay.
We go on the road for a visit with Dillingham's Dr. Dan O'Connell.
A famous old monk from years ago said that I haven't seen a sickness I couldn't walk away from.
Plus, a trip around town with an avid bird watcher and veteran reporter of all sports on the Iditarod Trail, Craig Medrid, gives some commentary from this season's races, plural. That's all coming up after a look back at some of this week's news. 57-year-old Mitch Seavey and his 11 Huskies crossed the Burled Arch in Nome Tuesday afternoon, finishing the race in 8 days, 3 hours, 40 minutes, and 13 seconds. KNOM's Ben Matheson was there as the now oldest musher to win the last great race came through.
Seavey started the race with a schedule that would bring him in under record time, but his fast team, one that he says loves speed, eclipsed even that schedule.
So that's pretty cool. The trail was a little faster and smoother than it might have been, but I really strongly believe in preparing the dogs to go do what they're going to do, and you shouldn't be really surprised at what happens.
With the victory, Seavey wins more than $70,000, a new truck, and bragging rights as a three-time champion, and now the fastest champion in 45 years of racing.
Mitch upset his son Dallas Seavey's previous race record and his hopes to win a fourth in a row. Dallas Seavey took second place this year, finishing about 3 hours behind. Last Friday, following a 4-1 vote, the Ekwok Village Corporation Board of Directors said they were leaving Nunamta Aluksti. Nunamta is an association of some of the area's village corporations and councils and has been a leading voice opposing the Pebble Mine. Ekwok Natives Limited new president Jimmy Hurley addressed the board's move shortly after.
We don't want no affiliation because on a long term you're looking at the safety of a small corporation like us to have risks with litigation, especially with what's going on in Washington, D.C. now with a new president and possibly with the Pebble Mine going through. We've got to look at a long run for shareholders.
Nunamta Aluksti said they have no current litigation pending with Pebble following a 2000 Alaska Supreme Court ruling in Nunamta's favor. Hurley said he has long opposed the Pebble project, but that he is interested in the employment opportunities it may provide. This week, regional air carrier Pinair addressed concerns over the number of delayed and canceled flights on its Bristol Bay to Anchorage routes. Sales and Marketing Vice President Missy Roberts says the bigger, faster Saab 2000s brought in last April are taking the company some getting used to.
A couple of our aircraft actually came from some NASCAR companies that were only using them on a private basis just to travel to move their crews around. So one of the things that is taking us a bit is to realize, you know, the idiosyncrasies of each one of those aircraft, and they all have their own personalities.
She says mechanical problems have added to usual delays from weather. The company says the Dillingham to Anchorage route has been completed 88% of the time so far this year, down from 96% in 2016. The governor's three nominees for the State Board of Fish had a first vetting in Juneau. The Senate Resources Committee heard from incumbents John Jensen of Petersburg and Reed Mariski of Fairbanks, as well as Fritz Johnson of Dillingham, who served one term before the governor dropped him last year. All three have received wide-ranging support from industry groups and individual stakeholders. Dillingham drifter Robert Hyano spoke favorably of all three, saying he appreciated their availability and professionalism at board meetings.
You know, I found them to do their due diligence and reviewing all the information before the meeting and during the meetings. And although I didn't necessarily agree with all their decisions, I walked away with the feeling that at least they were informed decisions. And I think it's very important to keep experienced people on the Board of Fish.
Since the 1970s, someone connected with Bristol Bay's fisheries has had a seat on the board until last year when Johnson was dropped. If confirmed, Johnson and Jensen will be the only two commercial fishermen on the board. The State House and Senate are moving forward their plans for next year's budget and for Alaska's fiscal future. The House majority will propose an income tax to supplement a permanent fund earnings draw in an effort to cut less state services. The Senate aims to cut another $200 to $300 million in state spending and avoid an income tax. Both sides seem to agree that a draw from the permanent fund earnings will be necessary to address the roughly $3 billion deficit. But as Senator Gary Stevens recently said, Alaskans have not yet told their elected officials what they want them to do.
When I've talked about income tax in Kodiak and Homer and Cordova, they've all said, well, we don't like it, but if you got to do it, do it. That's what I hear in my district. But that's not true throughout the state. I think in Fairbanks, in the Valley, large areas of Alaska, there's absolutely no intention of even considering an income tax. And that's where the people of Alaska are.
The House is continuing debates on budget amendments today and intends to take a vote next week. The Senate has passed a bill to restructure the permanent fund and is taking public testimony on its operating budget this week. In high school sports, both the New Haven Malamutes and the Bristol Bay Lady Angels are still alive in their quest for a state title. The Dillingham Lady Wolverines fell in their opener to Nenana last night, and the Bristol Bay boys team was topped by top-seeded Unalaska yesterday morning. Going into the tournament, Lady Angels coach Heath Lyon said he would have preferred not to have been ranked number one going into the 2A tournament.
Yeah, I'd rather be the underdog so you don't get the extra pressure, I guess you would say. You know, and even as the one seed, you get everybody's best game.
His Angels crushed the team from Chivac 73-30 in their opener and take on Glen Allen tonight at 7 in the semifinals. Coach Bob Rychnovsky's New Haven Malamutes are up against Gamble in the semis tonight at 8:30. More on this week's news can be found at our website, kdlg.org. This is Bristol Bay and Beyond on KDLG. I'm Dave Benninger. The action was lively in the state's capital this week. On the House side, the Republicans in the minority were pressing for hundreds of amendments to the budget, most of which would cut state spending by potentially hundreds of millions of dollars more. The majority caucus, led by House Speaker Bryce Edgman from Dillingham, pressed to curb that debate and move the process forward to talk about revenue, like an income tax and permanent fund restructuring. Edgman joined me early this morning by phone from Juneau for an update. Mr. Speaker, good morning, and thanks for making a brief moment here for us.
Good morning, Dave. My pleasure to be with you for a few minutes.
So one of the most exciting times of the legislative session is when the House gets that budget on the floor and debates many of these amendments. Can you give us an update from your perspective how this process is going?
Well, the debate on the operating budget on the floor has been ongoing for, 4 days as of yesterday, 5 days today, and that on the heels of a couple of weeks in House Finance and certainly, you know, building up from essentially the first day of session. So we've been talking about the operating budget for some time, and, our plan is to be done with the operating budget today in terms of amendments, Friday that is, and then on Monday, early next week, begin debating on the bill itself.
What I gathered from keeping an eye on things yesterday was that the House Republicans in the minority caucus would like to see more trimming of the budget, maybe something more akin to what the Senate is proposing on their side. And it seems that your majority caucus in the House has sort of decided this is where it needs to be and would like to start talking about how to pay for it now. Is that sort of where things are at?
I would say that that's an accurate characterization, and really the debate on the House floor is sort of pointing to the very different philosophies and approaches to putting the state's budget together and really to creating a pathway for a sustainable future for Alaska. The caucus I'm involved in believes that we have already cut the budget considerably over the years, and to cut it further is to eliminate core services. And that we think that our problem is more around the lines of creating a comprehensive fiscal plan and of trimming the budget as opposed to making large wholesale reductions that, from a rural legislator's perspective anyway, would, you know, be very damaging to our smaller communities throughout the state.
It looks like both the House and the Senate, as well as the governor, are agreeing now towards the idea that a substantial amount of money will need to come from the permanent fund earnings. It seems like that agreement is taking shape anyway. The Senate's passed their version. What's left in the mix there is any other new revenue, and that the House has proposed the income tax. The Senate still says, look, we can cut the budget more before even talking about that. What happens at the end of the session? You've got about a month left as of today if we're to gavel out on time.
Well, first things first, we've got to get the operating budget over to the Senate, which I expect we will in the next few days, and then the conversation on other bigger picture items such as revenue measures like creating an endowment from the permanent fund and any additional broad-based measures like an income tax, those conversations will follow. So I expect the negotiations to intensify and really to see a lot more back and forth on what it would take to hopefully get us out on 90 days, which honestly I don't think anybody at this point believes is attainable.
Yesterday, after around the lunch hour, after some pretty lively debate on the House floor, the minority caucus took to a press conference to air their grievances. And I want to play a short clip of what your colleague, Representative Charisse Millett, had to say there.
In my 9 years as a legislator and being down here as a staffer before that, I've never seen a speaker act in the manner in which he's acting, upholding the ruling of the chair on using words like slush fund and bureaucrat. I mean, not to mention the freedom of speech side of this, but we're trying to have an honest discussion.
She went on from there several times saying a similar thing, but the members in the Republican caucus there were critical of the debate cutting off. You took to another press conference to say, not the case. We've done this since day one. We've been addressing the same issues since day one.
Well, you know, politics. You're going to hear comments like that, regardless of who's involved, and I'm not surprised to hear a commentary like that. My hope would be to, to stick to the larger goal of doing what's best for the state. That's what we're trying to do. But again, I'm not surprised, we're doing our best in our coalition to rise above any personal differences that might be out there, any political differences, and try to do what the right thing is for the state.
All right. And Representative Edgman, you're coming home to Dillingham perhaps this weekend to hear from constituents directly, if the conditions allow. Is that correct?
That's my hope, and that would be tomorrow at the Dillingham LIO. I guess the caveat being that it's contingent upon getting business done here in Juneau. And I'm hopeful I can be there, and I'd look forward to meeting with as many constituents, friends, and certainly be home at least part of the weekend with family.
Bryce Edgman, a Dillingham Democrat, is Speaker of Alaska's House and will guide procedures there over what we expect to be a lively couple of weeks. Mr. Speaker, thanks so much.
It's been my pleasure, Dave. Thank you.
Another very interesting conversation that happened this week in Juneau was led by family nurse practitioner Dr. Jill Green. For several years, Green has been promoting the use of Vivitrol to treat opiate addiction. She's been working with Alaska's Department of Corrections to use that once-a-month shot before some prisoners leave custody, and she says the success rate is staggering. But few people have heard much about Vivitrol, and so far few providers are turning to it as an option for helping opiate addicts recover. I spoke to Dr. Green to learn more about it earlier this morning.
Vivitrol, it's an extended-release naltrexone, and naltrexone in the pill form has been out for decades, and it has been used for alcoholism for years. What it does is it just reduces the reward. If you do drink, it doesn't make you sick and it doesn't make you vomit. It just reduces that heightened pleasure reward that you get if you drink alcohol. It is also known to be a new opioid receptor blockade. So if you take the pill or the shot, it literally blocks all of your opiate receptor sites so that if you do use opioids, then it has nowhere to bind. So that if you had to do a urine drug screen, you would be positive, but you would not get high. And if you get the shot form, you can't get high for 30 days, which is incredible. And this was, the shot form was released in 2006, the FDA approved it for alcohol dependency, and in 2010, they approved it for opioid dependency. And I would just say that the uptake and the use has been really sporadic and underwhelming since then. I think we started this project with Partners Reentry Center to see if we could give recently released prisoners the injection on day of release. We started that in September of 2015. At that time, there were less than, I think, 70 shots a month being given in the whole state of Alaska. Now we're up to 200 shots a month being given in the state of Alaska. But that is still very much overshadowed by prescriptions for methadone or Suboxone in this state.
Okay.
And I'm not sure why.
When you talk about giving it to folks who are coming out of prison, the goal then is to keep them from relapsing, like, immediately, correct?
That's correct. I think that, you know, the lead up to getting out, there's a lot of anticipation about being back into your community, especially in rural Alaska. You know, it can be difficult to get back to rural Alaska after you've been incarcerated. But that first moment of hitting the parking lot and reintegrating with your old friends and acquaintances is a really vulnerable time. You don't have a lot of resources at that moment. You're not employed. You know, you don't even have an ID card when you get released. You don't have health insurance. So it's just a really vulnerable time. So it's important to give people that safety net so that if they release back out to their communities, that at least for 1 month, we know that they're going to be clean and sober, and that we can work over that next 4 weeks to getting them in for their next injection so we can continue to work on all the other life skills we need to keep people in sobriety.
And it's working.
It's working. I mean, the study that we did with Partners Reentry Center was phenomenal. Just in 6 months, we watched participants that accepted the same withdrawal shot in the first 6 months, and the group's pretty well evenly divided. Like, about the same number of people said, I don't really want to take that shot. The other half said, sure, I'll try it. I've got nothing else to try here. I'm out of chances. And of the people who did not take the injection, 95% of them were back in prison within 6 months. And of the people who said, sure, I'll give it a try, only 38% went back to prison. So it's got a huge impact, especially in recidivism. But because we're giving it to this population, we're seeing a lot of other non-incarcerated community members in the Anchorage area getting this injection. I'm even getting people flying in from other, you know, like Fairbanks, just because the access to the injection can be poor.
That's what I'd like to ask you about is, people are starved for some sort of solution to this addiction epidemic with opioids. And we know that there are such tight controls around methadone that it's not likely to be accessible in rural Alaska. How would this compare? And do you think that it's a solution the state could embrace on a larger scale?
I think the state is really looking forward to embracing this on a larger scale. I don't think that this is a one-size-fits-all, and I don't think that Vivitrol is a magic bullet for anybody. It is a safety net. It allows your brain to stop craving opioids and alcohol within 3 hours of getting the injection. You could walk to your dealer and think, you know what, actually, I'm okay. And in that time, and that clear head that seems to get clearer, you know, after about the third shot, your brain is very calm. Then you can start to work on the rest of your life. And you're right. The problem is that the smaller rural communities and a lot of the native health corporations have not been willing to pick this up and stock this medication out in the rural areas, which is a huge disservice because, as you know, a lot of rural communities in Alaska suffer very high rates of dependency.
What are the barriers? What's the apprehension?
I think there's a lot of barriers. Number one is it's just apprehension. It's still, even though it's been out for quite some time, 10 years now in the injection, there's still this, it's invasive. I don't know a lot about it. You know, it sounds too much, right? And it almost sounds too good to be true. The other thing is the cost. If you did not have insurance and you had to go to your local pharmacy to purchase it, the cash pay price is usually around $1,200, although I will say that the Alkermes, the pharmaceutical company, has a coupon that takes $500 off of that. So worst-case scenario, for non-native, non-covered individuals, it would cost $700. that is roughly the cost. That's less than the cost of 1 week of heroin if your average use is less than a gram a day.
And out here, it's even higher to stay addicted to heroin. The price goes up tenfold at times because of the further transport costs. So
that's right. So it's in relativity, the cost is very minimal. And I just think, you know, for usually for federally funded entities, the injection's around $600 to purchase. And I'm not sure why the reluctance. I just think it's lack of knowledge and lack of seeing the outcomes and the benefits. It's pretty amazing.
And you've taken this message to Juneau this week, and you've been working with Department of Corrections, I understand. What's next? How do you bring more people to understand about this and give it a whirl?
Well, I have been speaking nonstop for the last year and a half about this topic, and I'm always surprised that there are people that have not heard my discussion yet. When we started this project, the whole goal was, wow, here we have this tool that if we can just get somebody clean for 4 weeks, then at least we can start to show them that there is life. There is a possibility to be a productive member of your community. And the people who were receiving the injection thought, wow, this is the first time I've enjoyed going to work for 10 years. And the whole goal of doing this project initially was to get attention from the Department of Corrections to start, you know, getting them moving towards a behind-the-walls program to give them that injection of Vivitrol in that, you know, day to week prior to their release, just to absolutely ensure their safety net. And then again, it gives them, you know, that month to get a warm handoff to a community health provider so they can continue getting the injection wherever they may live. There is no regulations. You buy it, you can prescribe it, you can stock it in your clinic. There are absolutely no barriers for prescribing, and there's really no need to monitor them. As long as they're coming back monthly and getting their shot, we don't even give them another urine drug screen in 30 days. We just give them their injection.
Dr. Jill Green, thank you so much for your time on this. Very fascinating stuff, and I know we'll be talking about it more in the future.
Thank you so much for the opportunity to speak with you.
Watching is a simple and kind of fun hobby. Maybe not as much as bird hunting, but still, whether you toss a scoop of sunflower seeds out on the porch or grab a pair of binos and head out for a hike, learning to spot and identify species is something anybody can learn to do. We sent KDLG's Lawrence Hamilton out for a day's birding with Togiak Refuge pilot biologist Kara Hillwig to see what can be seen this time of year or heard and learn more about the hobby. He filed this report.
That was Kara Hillwig imitating a black-capped chickadee and its call, which sounds like the word cheeseburger. Kara knows a lot about local birds, including the black-capped chickadee.
With a black-capped chickadee, this is and it's universally considered cute because his head is so big and his body is small, quite curious. These are the ones that you often see pictures of taking seed out of people's hands.
Kara is a pilot biologist at the Togiak National Wildlife Refuge. And being a pilot biologist, a biologist who flies a plane, is the perfect job for her.
So when I completed my master's degree at Northern Arizona University in Flagstaff, part of the gift to myself for completing the degree was a private pilot's license. So I always had the aviation interest, but the motivation for coming up to Alaska was actually biology. Through my biology career, I'd always wanted to figure out how to combine piloting with biology.
Even today, Kara studies the birds and uses their lift as a way to help her fly.
There has been many a time when I have been out there flying, have just wanted a little bit more lift. If I looked around and found a bird and flew towards the bird, an eagle or a raven or a hawk, inevitably within that circle that the bird was flying, I'd get a little bit of lift.
Kara has an amazing ability to mimic many of the calls of the birds found here in southwest Alaska, like the hawk owl.
If you see an owl-like bird on the treetops that seems to have a long tail, that's likely the hawk owl. They're thought to be able to detect prey up to a half mile away by sight, primarily.
Kara has been in love with birds since she was a small girl, and her dad was a veterinarian who often treated injured or abandoned wildlife.
And so every year, every spring, we'd get a lot of young baby quail which were quite fascinating because they would bond to whatever was taking care of them. So as a kid, you can just imagine, you know, a six-year-old kid walking through the desert in her backyard and having six or eight baby quail in tow because they had bonded to me and I was feeding them and taking care of them. You know, that was very much a wonderful experience in my childhood.
Kara recently took me around the birding hotspots of Dillingham to share her enthusiasm and knowledge of local bird life. First up on our bird watching afternoon was the Dillingham landfill, a hotspot for bird watching. In that last year's annual Christmas bird count, a place where there were over 20 bald eagles and 150 ravens.
To the left of the pit, there's two ravens in a tree, and they're preening each other. Well, right about this time of year, they're starting to pair bond, and so you'll see these behaviors where a pair will sort of separate from the group, and they'll interact with each other in often touching ways that people perceive. Ravens have several sounds. They have the normal call sound, but then researchers have recently discovered that there's also what they're categorizing as a comfort sound that these pair bonds will actually make with each other. The normal raven call, you know, you'll hear something like that, but then when these pairs are together, it's, you know, sweet little sounds, you know. That's what they're calling the comfort sounds.
After our successful trip out to the landfill, we went to some other bird hotspots around Dillingham, or not so hotspots. We tried behind the hospital.
There are absolutely no birds out here.
Kanakanak Beach.
And we didn't see any birds there.
To the harbor, where we didn't see any birds, but we did see a very sad bald eagle through town. And then finally, out to Wood River. On the way out there, we discussed one surefire way to see birds, and that was by using a feeder.
Birds are so uniquely accessible to people because you can put up an attractant thing like a feeder and bring nature closer to you.
At Wood River, we finally saw what we've been looking for, some birds.
And it's amazing what you see through the binoculars when you're really hunting for something. Okay, I hear those red poles somewhere over there, and you put the binoculars up. Next thing you know, you see a magpie building a nest or an owl that you wouldn't have seen otherwise. Just looking through a pair of binoculars is just extraordinary. It just brings the world right to you.
Kara said those interested in continuing birding should join a social group of birders or set up a basic feeder. And on those days when you don't see any birds, she offered one last piece of advice.
There's a little trick birders do to try to pique the curiosity of that bird that's out there in the bushes. And you just kind of chat at it a little bit, give what's similar to most birds' alarm calls. And that's a
in Dillingham, I'm Lawrence Hamilton.
This is Bristol Bay and Beyond. Next, let's hit the road with Dillingham's Dr. Dan O'Connell. He arrived in 1967 in the region to work at the Kanakanak Hospital. For years, he ran the 5 miles to work every day. An injury put those running days to an end, but he still makes that walk once a week. Early this morning, KDLG's Avery Lill caught up with Dr. Dan on his weekly trek to talk about healthcare in the area, what's changed over the years, and what remains the same.
If you believe in God, you'll say God made man to stay in motion. If you believe in nature, you'll say that nature made man to stay in motion. And if we don't walk, we deteriorate. You got to go back. I'm a former runner. I got caught up in the marathon craze of the 1970s. And here in Dillingham, I used to run to work each day. Circumstances are such now that I can't run anymore, and I can't walk 5 miles a day just because it's so much slower. So I walk 2 miles a day, and once a week I walk to the hospital, which is 5 miles. Well, when I first came to Dillingham, there was one dentist, two physicians, and so we were actually spread pretty thin. Now we have the same number of villages and 8 doctors and 4 or 5 dentists. So we're able to do a lot more village travel. When we first came to rural Alaska, there were no phones in the villages. And so the old, what they called AM radios, which were used on the fishing boats and in the schools and in the canneries, was the only means of communication. And it was sort of haphazard, depending on weather, depending on location. They would probably knock on the school teacher's door or the cannery, the person that was taking care of the cannery over the winter, and ask if they could use the radio. And our radio was on all the time. So somebody'd hear them calling, then you'd get back and have a two-way conversation and negotiate what should be done in the village and the appropriateness of sending out an airplane to pick somebody up. The disease pattern has really changed. And back when I first came here, tuberculosis was a big problem. Also, other infectious diseases that have been eliminated with the introduction of vaccines. Tuberculosis, we see an occasional case, but we'll go 2-3 years at Kadakanak without an active case. And back in the 60s, we'd see 10 to 15 per year. The main issue right now is alcoholism. And over the past few years, drugs, and particularly heroin, but alcoholism is still the one of the major causes of family disruptions, child abuse, domestic violence, accidents, shootings, stabbings. Another huge change that started back in the 50s, in the 60s. Before that time, everybody was active. You saw no fat kids. Hardly anybody was overweight. There was no diabetes. Rare exceptions. And then came outboard engines and snow machines and chainsaws and tools to cut holes in the ice. And so the activity level of the general population has decreased. And, you know, it's not all bad, but there are certain aspects of it are really unfortunate. The increase in heart disease, the increase in diabetes, obesity, all of these are related to diet and exercise. I attend a medical meeting each year at the University of Washington. Slow down here. I compare my notes from year to year, and it's very interesting that some things don't change. The dose of aspirin changes, and antibiotics change, heart medicine changes, but the most frequently recommended treatment program at the University of Washington is walking, and that hasn't changed over 50 years. I think it's pretty well proven that no matter what illness you have, staying fit and active will be of benefit. A famous old monk from years ago said that, "I haven't seen a sickness I couldn't walk away from."
Dr. Dan O'Connell is the most recent in a series of community profiles we've been airing here at KDLG. A full story of Dr. O'Connell's time serving as a doctor in the Bristol Bay community is coming up later next week. Finally, on this week's program, Craig Medrid is a veteran of the news business in Alaska, and since his departure from Alaska Dispatch News, has been offering his unique view on many topics at his own blog, craigmedrid.news. His commentary on Iditarod sports is second to none, and I invited him on earlier this morning to talk more about that.
It was fast. It was very, very fast, and I think set a precedent for how all of these races are likely to be run by now. It certainly shows a CV family dominance like something we've never seen in the Iditarod. I mean, you can go back to dynasties, but to have one family capable of producing a pool of dogs that puts a 1-2 punch in a race is, there's never, I mean, it's been people competitive and some handler running a puppy team. We've never seen anything like this.
Aside from seeing some more competition to keep it a little livelier, what you're critical also about the dogs and the sleds and even the trail lately.
Well, I mean, at some point we go, it's just inevitable, we go faster than the dogs can handle. That's just a given. I'm critical of the trail this year mainly because of the Fairbanks start, which makes it a pretty fast and easy start, which is hard for a lot of people to restrain themselves. You go too hard, too fast early, you get to the coast with dogs that have lost weight and aren't in the best condition they should be. I think a number of the vets I've talked to, and they've had this concern for years with getting skinny dogs to the coast. I mean, if you get a bunch of skinny dogs to the coast and a big storm hits, we could have a nasty, nasty disaster out there. Somebody needs to figure out some way to slow the race down a bit earlier just to kind of get more food in the dogs and not burn so many calories and not lose so much body fat before they get to the coast. And I know vets have talked about a lot of ways to do that, and there's no simple way to do that, because if you force rest, if you tell people you have to rest X number of hours in, you know, certain checkpoints, what tends to happen is that they just run faster between the checkpoints because they know they're going to have the mandatory rest. In some ways, that's actually worse for the dog. So I don't know what the solution there is. My personal solution is if the trail's worse, they slow down because the mushers have a rougher ride, and that's a good thing.
Any way to do that? Or could they have started in Anchorage, in your opinion?
In my opinion, yeah. The bikers who went through the Alaska Range had no problems. There was plenty of snow. Trail wasn't that bad. I think part of the issue here was cost. I talked to people in Iditarod, said it's about 30% cheaper to go out of Fairbanks because they don't have the cost of supplying remote checkpoints they have to, you know, charter stuff into. So, I mean, there are good arguments, I think, for making Fairbanks a permanent restart on that basis. It really cuts your cost down, gives you access to another pool of people who might want to be sponsors. You know, you could sell a second set of Iditarides and drop people off at Nanana or somewhere just outside of Fairbanks and boost some revenue that way. I mean, there's some good arguments for it, but, boy, you need to get mushers to kind of buy in and agree to not race so hard that first third or half if you're going to do that.
You were pretty critical of a documentary that came out last year that was rather critical of sled dogs in general. What do you think this year's race will do to that perception now that the body count of dogs who have been killed through the course of this race, regardless of the reason, is growing?
I think it couldn't have been a worse alignment of coincidences. I mean, I'm told the movie now has a national distributor that is going to be marketed outside. I going into this race, it was my personal nightmare that we'd see a bunch of deaths this year with that movie out there and kind of just, you know, looking for someone to take it to market. The alignment's not good.
You are one of, if not the only, reporters who covers the other side of racing this trail on bike.
Yeah, which I don't understand. I mean, those races are fun.
I think there's a lot of us who say they're way more interesting, and we'd like to know more about them and but you have been covering them through the years, and especially this year. What did you see this year? What was the most exciting aspect of either a bike team or the foot race?
Well, I think the most interesting thing I saw this year was kind of, you know, a reversion to 2 years ago. I mean, I can't even remember when I covered the first one of those. It was sometimes in the 80s because John Stamstead, who's now long retired, was a dominant force then. And those races were, I mean, they were nothing but a struggle from the beginning to the end. I mean, fat tires had yet to arrive. There was a lot less rideable trail. I remember we hit 50 below at Roan 1 year, and the overflow got horrible on the Cusco downriver, and nobody could get across it. You know, they'd figure out all kinds of systems to, you know, make themselves waterproof and go out and come back icemen, and, you know, they'd come in the cabin and it'd just be this big steam ball. I mean, it was kind of that old Jack London kind of stuff that was great. And we got some of that back this year after a couple of years when, I mean, last couple of years, it was kind of pavement. I mean, you got on your bike and you just rode to Nome like you're on a highway. And I think people this year got a taste again of what it's like when it's not like that. They got wind, they got blowing snow, the trail drifted in. It was a lot of work. And from a reporter standpoint, a writer standpoint, people struggling out there are a lot more interesting than people on a high-speed bike ride to McGrath.
Craig, what do you turn your Cerbic pen to next as these winter or spring sports wrap up?
I'm going back to writing about fish a bit, which are interesting issues here. Politics is heating up again. The legislature's trying to figure out what to do about our economy. There are no good answers. We got lots of oil in the ground in the North Slope now that we could bring to market if they don't mess that up.
We'll look forward to those writings in the weeks and months ahead at craigmedrid.news. Craig, it's good to speak with you. Thanks so much, sir.
I appreciate it. I enjoyed it.
That's it for this week's show. You can find this and past episodes of Bristol Bay and Beyond at our website, kdlg.org. Keep in touch with feedback and story ideas. Dave@kdlg.org is the email to use. My thanks to Avery Lill and Lawrence Hamilton for their help this week. I'm Dave Benninger. We'll see you back here next Friday.